I accidentally added somebody. I didn't mean to, though.
Probably a porn bot.
Oh, good.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Richard Wally, you are my co-host from Portland, Oregon.
And Cassidy Robinson, you are my co-host from LA area stuff.
This is a morning show.
Yeah, that means something to us.
Yes,
it
does.
It's not going to go as well as we want it to.
Well, we can hope not, anyways. Or we can hope that it does.
We can hope.
Today we're going to be reviewing the BFG, Steven Spielberg's The BFG, and at the end of the program we're going to review the Netflix original movie, The Do-Over.
Adam Sandler one, too.
The Adam Sandler film, yes, we're going to do it. But first I have to ask you.
Okay.
Have you caught the fever?
We've caught some of the fever, yes. We've took pokey walks, if that's what you're... If that's what you're referring to.
Is that sad that that's the big event for my last week?
I don't know. It's like kind of half and half, because this is the thing. It's an interesting new, like, kind of video game.
Sure.
And it is different. I understand why people are excited about it, but I also understand why there's some people like, what is this bullshit? And it is bullshit. but I think it's a pleasant one, at least. It's not, like, bad, right. And...
It's a frivolity, and unfortunately it was released the same weekend a lot of crazy ass violence and horribleness is happening out in the world.
Exactly.
So it couldn't feel less appropriate in the news cycle right now, but there it is. And, you know, nothing's keeping it down either.
Well, I think it's just a nice distraction. I mean, it is what it is.
So you were able to download it, because I wasn't sure if Android users could use Pokemon Go.
Android is bigger than Apple, Cassidy. Why wouldn't they be able to?
I don't know, because I just wondered if, like, the commands or whatever the mainframe. I don't. I'm just using words that I've heard in cyberpunk movies at this point.
from the early 80s.
Right.
It works. It works perfectly. It's a smartphone, just like those other smartphones.
Right.
It works fine. We wander around our neighborhood catching make believe critters and
pocket monsters, if you will.
Yes, pocket monsters, if you will. No, it's great, because I'm one of those people. I find walks in your neighborhood fairly boring. You live in your neighborhood, you know what's around you. I people are like, it's nice to get out, and I'm like, I guess. but this for me is good, because it's like it's a way to entertain myself while I'm walking around and getting some exercise in the way. Sure. You kind of talk with people a little bit that you haven't. Sometimes it's strange. I was waiting for Jackie while she was doing something, and I was standing outside, and I was catching me some Pokemon.
Uh-huh.
This like 12-year-old kid ran up to me while I was in the middle of doing it. I was like, "What are you catching?" And I'm like, "Oh my gosh." And I was like, I'm just doing this right now. And I just showed him the phone, and he was like, "Oh yeah, those ones are hard to get." And then he ran away, and I was like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, I kind of had an incident like that last night. I was walking from the movie theater to find my a restaurant that was nearby or something like that. And anytime I'm in a new area that I'm, or, you know, it's just an area that's not my house or work,
mm-hmm.
I'll turn it on to see if anything's different.
No, sure.
And I was just taking a few steps, and then, you know, what should appear but a Zubat in front of me. So I was standing there, you know, throwing Pokeballs at it and not thinking anything of it. And then somebody in a car behind me, not even like our age, like somebody like who's like in his like mid 40s, was like, "Oh yeah, Pokemon Go, catch them all, woo!" I was like, I'm slightly embarrassed, and I don't know if you're making fun of me, if you're really that excited. So that happened.
We have seen a wide age range of people doing this. It might be, I wasn't sure if it was a Portland thing or not.
Yeah.
There was definitely, we were out, when we did our longest Pokemon walk, walkabout, there was like probably, he was in his 40s or 50s out there doing it as well. I don't know. It's amusing. Also, I mean, I do like that it's interactive and that it is, you actually have to do something besides just sit there.
I mean, it is different from Angry Birds in that sense, because one could just compare the phenomena to that. There's a lot of games, you know, Bejeweled or Angry Birds or Draw with Friends. There's a lot of games that caught on in a big way really fast.
Right.
But this one, A, taps into the whole nostalgia thing for our generation and for people slightly younger. Mm-hmm. And then B is one of the first games I can think of that like includes a map. And like, I mean, maybe this kind of started like X amount of years ago when Google Earth did that whole thing. You remember that?
No.
Google Earth for, I want to say it was for a holiday or something, for a couple days, they put a Pokemon map overlaid on top of the regular Google Earth map, and on your computer, you could walk around your neighborhoods and stuff, and, you know, there was like a catching Pokemon kind of like skin that was put on top of the map. And it was, you know, people were taking pictures, like, computer stills or whatever, screenshots, and posting them to their Facebook and that kind of stuff when that was going on. So I want to say that was probably like the lead up to why this game happened. I have some grievances though.
The company that designed it, they also have a game that's called Ingress that's very similar. And
but nobody gave a shit because they never heard of their lame ass original idea.
right. until you introduce Pokemon to the same, almost exact same idea.
Right.
The other thing, too, is I have heard somebody when they're explaining it to their grandmother on Facebook.
Yeah.
They refer to it as geocaching. It's kind of, they're like, it's like geocaching. I was like, oh, I guess it is.
but digital. Yeah.
Yeah.
But my issue with it is, you know, having grown up playing the video game when I was in middle school and stuff, I think it's too easy. It's too much of a casual gaming experience. Like I get that like people don't really want to like hardcore get into playing a game when they're like out just like walking with friends and stuff. Mm-hmm. But you used to have to battle a damn Pokemon to catch a damn Pokemon. No, you didn't just throw a ball at it and catch it. You had to like weaken it to a certain point, and if you didn't weaken it enough, it would escape from the ball, and then if you weakened it too much, it would just die, and you'd have to walk around till you found one again. And usually you found like lame Pokemon, like 99.9% of the time. Like you didn't catch like a Cubone in your first hour. You would find, you know, a Pidgey and a Rattata for like the first like 7 days of playing the game.
Well, I've heard depending where you are, you catch different ones. Like I've caught mostly lame Pokemon, honestly. Yeah. But also there are different levels. There are the green ones that are easier to catch. There are the yellow ones that are harder to catch. And then there are the red ones that are almost impossible to catch. So just because you haven't encountered any hardcore Pokemon doesn't mean they don't. You're belittling a younger generation's struggles, Cassidy, just because you don't understand them.
I had to walk digitally through the snow.
Yeah, did you actually have to walk?
No, I sat in my parents' car playing it with my gigantic VHS-sized handheld gaming system plugged into the cigarette lighter.
See, these kids these days, they have to actually walk around their neighborhood and catch them.
Yeah, I think some people are making too much of this whole like exercise thing, though. I mean, I play mostly when I'm in traffic. Most of the Pokemon I've caught have been inside of my car.
Well, Cassidy, that sounds like a personal problem. That doesn't sound like.
I'm glad we got that out of the way.
Yeah, yeah.
We had to discuss it. We didn't want to, but we had to. Let's get into the movie news.
Let's do this.
Let's do the movie news. I'll start out with this one. This is a kind of older story that I posted last week or the week before. According to Deadline, the Russo brothers, who directed the last few Captain America movies, are going to be doing their take on The Warriors, the Walter Hill film from 1979, 1980, with Paramount TV and Hulu. So I've been reading this story up and down. I don't know if this is supposed to be a television series, like a one season thing or a miniseries, or a movie remake. But that seems weird to me only because, like, if they're going to go so far as to get a property like The Warriors, which has, you know, a pretty recognizable IP at this point, and reboot it.
Isn't it kind of a cult one, though?
It's a cult movie, but, I mean, they've rebooted cultier and put it back into the screens.
That's true.
So it seems like if it was just a TV movie, it seems a little bit like a waste. But, yeah, what do you think about this?
Well, first of all, you said Hulu. So original content is starting to make bigger and bigger bounds in what they do and what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting. The Russos do, like, really great, like, action work, so I'm excited in that sense. I guess my only qualms is one of the enduring, like, lovability of that movie is the cheese appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And this just isn't a very campy, like, decade. This is the we need to be realistic decade,
right?
And or time period, I should say. So I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. I do. It does bring up another question to me, is like, why aren't, if this is more of a TV movie, why aren't there more TV movies now? Or is that just, or is that going to be more of a Netflix original kind of?
If this is an original film, then that is kind of the model, is the Netflix original, which in a way one could argue is kind of the new TV movie,
because
it's not getting regular distribution, but at the same time, it's not really, because it's getting most of these movies, like the do-over that we're going to talk about later, or like, what was that one? Beasts of No Nation that we reviewed. Those are like real movies with budgets and locations. And, you know, back in the day, TV movies, you could tell they were TV movies and there was a certain charm to their cheapness.
Yeah.
Lifetime still makes their movies. The Hallmark Channel still makes their movies.
Well, I remember those ones, like there was Merlin and Ulysses.
Yeah. The TV movie of the week used to be like a real kind of event thing up even through when we were kids, and they kind of
stand it.
Yeah, there was all the Stephen King ones, or the miniseries that was like over a 2-day event, or I used to watch a lot of those. I remember there was that one with Julia Stiles and Jerry. Oh, I can't think of his name now. But the 60s.
Oh, I
remember that.
No, I don't.
Oh, there was. It was like a recap of the 60s, like all the crazy events that happened in the late 60s. And it was done through the eyes of this suburban family and all of its different family members that just happened to be included in every event that happened in the country at that time. Like one kid went to Vietnam, and then the daughter went to Haight-Ashbury. And then like one kid became a writer, the colleges and that kind of stuff. And one kid got involved in civil rights and. So it was kind of written contrived, but I actually thought that as a movie, it was kind of better than most, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's hard to tell anymore too.
Yeah.
Because things date strangely, especially with television movies. But I mean, the thing with these kind of things though, too, is that now that you have, besides budgets, you don't have to pay for film like you used to.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, technology in general, I mean, CG is getting cheaper and so you can make like relatively like what would be a big film in the 70s as a TV movie now, you know?
What I mean? Yeah.
So it's sort of a strain. We're still kind of, we haven't really done it differently because we're still kind of breaking out of those traditions, but there's still a lot of room to grow into that. And so these Netflix originals, I find to be an interesting new category for film or TV. Or whatever they're supposed to be.
Whatever you're, yeah. I mean, they don't. It almost kind of defies traditional modes of marketing in that sense. So, I mean, I'm kind of with you as far as the Warriors goes. I think a big part of the charm of that movie is when it came out. It's a product of its time. And it kind of exists, like a lot of Walter Hill movies. It exists in its own movie universe. It doesn't really feel like the actual world, even the world back then. It's, you know, the gangs are, it's almost kind of post-apocalyptic in a way.
Well, it's pre-Mad Max post-apocalyptic, which is a very different thing. And I don't think sometimes people realize how much of a corner, well, I think most people do realize, I take that back, how much of a cornerstone that Mad Max was for those films. But ever since that, the Mad Max films, post-apocalypse films just look, you know, vastly different.
Right. And the Warriors, I mean, it's in its own kind of movie land. And I don't know. They might go that direction. And in a way, would that feel weird if they were like just kind of did it like Walter Hill did it, but a little slicker?
Yeah, I see that. That's the thing, is I don't know. I do have trust in the Russos. I think they're pretty good at what they do.
Yeah.
But I don't know what this thing is. So I would like, before I comment much more, I'd rather just see a trailer, what they're trying to do with it. So
likewise.
Moving on. Blade Runner, it's been happening for a while. It's going to be the sequel. It's going to be done by Denis Villeneuve. They've been adding cast members here and there. Somebody they recently added though was Bakar Abdi. He was one of the main pirates in the Captain Phillips movie a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So he's just been added to the cast, which I think is good. Also some of the other people added to that cast, some of them I don't know though, Ana de Armas, Sylvia Hawks, Carla Drury, and the only name I really know is Dave Bautista. I don't know. It seems like an interesting cast, and I like which direction it's headed in general. So,
Do you think he's going to be a robot?
Well, it's hard to say in this universe. is everybody?
Yeah, fair enough.
In this universe, because there's not really a good. I mean that's kind of the point of the whole thing is what's the difference. I don't know. I don't know which direction they're going with it. As a sequel, it will be strange. So, but again, I really like Denis Villeneuve, and he happens to have an interesting perspective, even when he's working within genres that have been hugely, hugely exploited. So, I'm just curious to see what this is, and the cast is at least interesting.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I think that if it wasn't for Denis Villeneuve's involvement in this project, I might not care as much. Mm-hmm. Even if it was Ridley Scott, you know, because he's not exactly a sure thing anymore. But I'm, you know, I don't know. I guess I'll take it. Again, it's another one of those I want to see a trailer kind of things. Just to see the, you know, what direction they're really going to take this in. And it's another cult property from the early 80s that only really found sort of recognition within the last 15 or so years.
Well, right now we're talking about something that kind of breaches on something I've been thinking about a lot lately. Because when something like Blade Runner that we talk about as a cult film and was very much a cult film at the time.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, it's a standard. So that's where I get confused about cult films sometimes.
Well, some things are later canonized.
Right.
That kind of happens. You know, there's a lot of movies from the golden age of Hollywood that we would consider, you know, classic films that, you know, people talk about and da da da. I mean, under our kind of rubric of what counts as cult anymore, you could put Citizen Kane in that category because that was a movie that wasn't recognized until, I think, quite a few decades later, other than by the awards cycle, or even Vertigo, and a lot of these kind of movies that stand the test of time were not the big box office films of their decades.
Sometimes not even well received.
Yeah, critically or otherwise.
Right.
Until like a later generation. That specifically happened a lot because of the whole auteurist theory that took hold in like the 50s and 60s. Then people started looking back into the classic Hollywood canon and decided, oh, it's these directors. And then their whole bodies of work started getting reevaluated. specifically genre directors. So, you know, that sort of process has been going on forever and ever and ever. And now it's kind of happening again where, you know, what we called cult films. I mean, hell, even the Criterion Collection is releasing Valley of the Dolls and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And I mean, I think they know that it's a cult property and they're not releasing it saying like, you know, this is film that is valued in the same sort of way that a Citizen Kane is or whatever. But they're saying this is an interesting look at a certain period of time under a certain kind of context to view these movies. So I don't know. Yeah, I think the first day of our cult cinema class, when I took it, he read off of a list. And, you know, it was a list of movies that most everybody's seen now. You know, movies like Fight Club, movies like Donnie Darko, that basically are just in the normal cultural conversation of film. And he was saying, you know, these are movies that qualify as being cult films because of X, Y, and Z.
There needs to be different levels of cult film, I think, now.
Well, there is.
There should be a way to kind of codify that, too, to be like, this is this type of cult film or this is this kind of cult film. And and in our conversations, I've noticed that happen quite a bit. But when we're talking cult, like that's just a word that gets flippantly kind of thrown around anymore.
Right. I mean, I think specifically when I say cult film, I'm talking about like a movie that might have not been appreciated on the whole by the greater public at the time, but has a specific audience that is very devoted to it. And what happens usually is that grassroots appreciation tends to spread into the next generations as those people, that specific cult, you know, starts getting jobs in Hollywood and making sequels. My second story is Javier Bardem is eyed to play Frankenstein in Universal's Frankenstein reboot movie universe thingy that they're trying to do. So yeah, you know, now we have Tom Cruise, Mummy. I don't know. You know, Alex Kurtzman is involved in this. I think this whole kind of endeavor is just sort of misbegotten. This whole idea of doing a Universal movie Amoebaverse. There's nothing about that idea that sounds interesting to me. To me, it seems antithetical to the whole point of horror film. And I think there's interesting directions you could take all of these properties that this is going to stifle. But what do you think?
I mostly agree. But for the sake of the podcast, I'm going to play the devil's advocate a little bit and kind of say that, you know, a lot of people do hold a lot of the Universal monsters specifically at this point as more of like a fantasy concept as opposed to a horror. It doesn't really jive with the same kind of concepts that we consider horror now.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the ghost story is like the oldest type of horror you can ever tell. Mm-hmm. Anyways, to get back to the point. So when you have all these, you could make adventure films. I mean, even if you're looking at the Mummy films that did fairly well at the time that they were released, they were adventure films more than they were horror films.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand if they're kind of going for those adventure kind of, I could see a take on it that would be fun, kind of like an Indiana Jonesy kind of like,
right.
Kind of flip through these different monsters.
Kind of what Stephen Sommers did, right? I mean,
we don't need to talk about that.
Well, I think we might need to, because if that is the direction they want to go, then that's kind of what we're getting into again.
Well, if you're talking about the Mummy, sure. I was thinking, maybe that wasn't Stephen Sommers, but I'm pretty sure it was the Van Helsing movie.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Well, if they're going that route completely, then it is a bad decision in my, you know, I think you have to still kind of consider what they are. The monsters themselves, but I can see a fun adaptation of this.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, in a period of, I love superheroes, but I'll be the first to say that it's problematic that they are the only thing that's being produced right now,
and the only thing making money,
which is problematic for Hollywood because that's what their main goal is. So it's hard to say. I would just like them to make a good product, of course, or at least entertaining, but just to have a different flavor in the mix.
I agree with you there. I think there's no problem with Universal like tapping the well again for the monsters. Unlike something like Blade Runner or The Warriors, which are very singular and of a time, I think the Universal monsters are very archetypal. And I think there's a way that you can retell those stories in a way that would be really interesting. And I think it's a shame. Well, I mean, I don't know. We can't say until we actually see the movies and know what direction they're taking it. I just, the movie universe idea just to me does not lead or lend itself to real horror. And you said that, you know, people kind of look at these movies a certain way now. I think that's why that's the direction they shouldn't go. Is
see, but you could also go back to the original kind of concepts of these books. Because, I mean, if we're talking about Dracula and we're talking about Frankenstein, they were all penny dreadfuls. And penny dreadfuls at the time were, you know, schlocky, one-off kind of like little things.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, them all being put together isn't necessarily that strange of an idea of a universe. My hesitancy more comes from how they're doing it rather than what they're doing.
Yeah. There's, I don't know. I guess I have to see something of it to kind of, I just don't have a lot of faith in Alex Kurtzman. I think him and Robert Orci are kind of Hollywood bean counter types, and they are, their names get attached to the biggest and the loudest properties.
I think that's kind of a marketing thing slash, I think what happens to some of these kind of guys too, like your Robert Orci's and your Alex Kurtzman's, and I can't think of some of the other people too, is I think at first they're producing really fun and decent work, and that's why they get a name for themselves. But once they get a name, everything under the sun is put under them.
Yeah.
And they just get stretched too thin. So I don't know. It just depends on how they're doing this. You know, I look at Universal, and the thing that Universal is making money off of right now is like Fast and the Furious and Jurassic World. And so you kind of see the kind of things that they want to do. So that's more kind of my predictor and kind of what I'm looking at and saying, I have a hesitancy about what you're doing here. However, having monsters be a thing again, I think is great. And also, I mean, I think superheroes are kind of just monsters in a lot of ways. So I don't see it as that different. I don't think it's necessarily what they're doing so much as who's doing it now.
Right, right. Javier Bardem's cool.
Yeah, and I've also heard it kind of go back and forth, like he could be playing the
creature or the doctor.
The creature or the doctor. Yeah. And I don't really care either way. He could be good.
Yeah.
In either role. As the monster, you know. We saw him as a scary monster. A very scary monster in No Country for Old Men, so it could work.
Yeah, that's gonna be a tough one to beat. As far as the scary factor goes. All right, let's go ahead and get into our movie reviews. We're going to start here with Steven Spielberg's The BFG, which came out last week and did not do well. Did not do well very well at all. But we're still talking about it. I guess for the very least, it's a Steven Spielberg event, and there's something to be said about that, I guess. This is a story that's based on the novel by Roald Dahl, a children's book. Roald Dahl's very prolific writer at a point in time. A lot of his work has been translated in the movies. The BFG itself was released in 1989 as an animated film, although I don't know if it ever had any kind of theatrical release. I only saw it on TV. You know, he's involved with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory and the same, what, James and the Giant Peach, The Witches, Matilda. Lots of stuff you're probably familiar with Roald Dahl in some way or another. Steven Spielberg took on this property. I think this is a property that's, if I'm not mistaken, has been in the works for a while. I remember reading about a BFG movie years ago. They've been trying to get this on the screen. And the basic story here is an orphan who lives in early 20th century London is kidnapped out of her bed from her orphanage by a big friendly giant and taken to Giant Land, where he teaches her all the ways of being a giant and you know, weird foods and sodas that make you fart and whatever. In Giant Land, there also exists a gang of man-eating evil giants who are kind of bullyish and bumbling. She's trying to sort of be an ambassador to the mainland for you know, the misinterpretation of giants because she's just befriended one of them. Does that sound about right?
It sounds, yeah. It's okay.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
You know what?
It's okay. You could have done better.
That's kind of my review for it. Eh, it's all right.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you vaguely... I wonder because of... I mean, we were kids when Hook came out. There was a lot of product placement around us at that time. Mm-hmm. And he happened to be a very, like... he happened to be at kind of one of the best times of his career at that time point.
Yeah, Steven Spielberg in particular, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so... I wonder if this is a similar thing. Will kids now enjoy this more than like an adult would? And mm-hmm. then like down the line now, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, Hook was great.
Because I was 7 when it came out.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But even kind of watching this, sometimes I was like, oh yeah, I remember those weird kind of slow, non-linear kind of idiosyncratic kind of movements in Hook. And that's what I was thinking about this is it does. There are lots of times where it feels meandery and feels a lot more like how a book should kind of lay out than a film. And so in that sense, it was not necessarily as streamlined mm-hmm. as sometimes you'd like to see a film. But there are definitely moments that are very enjoyable. But there are moments that you're like, what? This seems awkward. Specifically when you first kind of get started introduced, I kind of wanted to know a little bit more about the girl and cause I never really felt like I got a very firm stance on her as a character.
Really just kind of throws you in. And I was trying to remember the cartoon cause I'd seen that a few times when I was a kid and liked it. And I was like, did it get off to a start this quickly? I feel like there was more about her and the orphanage and shit.
I think so, because that's what I was trying to remember, too, because I only saw the cartoon, I think, once, but I had read the book at least once or twice when I was a kid. And I remember them like being at the orphanage and talking about giants, too, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of had this like idea of like, oh, they're big and scary. And then so when she actually gets abducted, you kind of have this weird because one thing I specifically remember from reading the book as a kid is I was very disappointed when I learned that the BFG was big and friendly. I was like, he's going to eat her. And then it didn't happen and I was disappointed.
Well, okay. That actually brings me to my first point that I wanted to make with this review. Mm-hmm. I found the movie to be altogether sort of lukewarm and tepid. It was fine for what it is, basically, but I ultimately kind of came out like the movie just kind of rolled off my back.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I wanted to, as a kid, the experience I was mining from that material, which mm-hmm. may or may not have been the point of the story, I don't know, was kind of the soft horror angle of it. Like, right. Because otherwise it's not really doing that much. Like, it's about a girl she goes to and hangs out with a friendly giant and, you know, fantasy world kind of stuff. But to me, the stuff that I was attracted to in that story was sort of the horror elements of it, of these big scary giants who in this movie are not that scary and are never really played to be. And I feel like that is, if you're going to do something with that story, that's what you do with it. And I obviously he wanted to make a family movie. He didn't want to make it like, you know, Roger Corman's The BFG, but yeah, to me, it's like because he kind of downplays the scariness of the giants. I mean, hell, even the abduction scene in Hook mm-hmm. is played a lot more scary right. than the abduction scene in this movie.
Well, I wonder if that's just modern sensibilities, too. That's kind of a common thing recently is avoiding horror at all costs.
Upsetting.
Questionable. Yes, or yeah. upsetting. I don't know. That is the reason. I mean, you do get these weird kind of funny interactions in the book. I remember that mm-hmm. for sure, because it brought back a lot of memories when I heard him starting to speak. And I remember
sure.
trying to figure out what the fuck he was saying when I was a kid. And I was like, what is he saying? And then finally you kind of catch on little bit by little bit. But the one thing I guess I did notice and I did kind of think positively about the movie was there was a real good set. Because a lot of times when you have these like shrinking or growing or whatever kind of films, they don't do very good in terms of ratio.
Right.
Like you don't get like the sense of, oh, this is really big or this is really small. I felt like this movie did really well in that, but you still didn't like, yeah, the giants were, they needed to be funnily scary. And instead they were just kind of oafish. And yeah. I don't know. It kind of took away from the narrative a little bit because you weren't really sure why they needed to negotiate that these giants were, you know, you got it from the narrative that it was a bad thing that these giants were coming and eating children.
Right.
But you didn't really get the sense or really feel that. So it didn't really have an impact.
So it felt to me like the movie had zero stakes. And it kind of wraps up pretty conveniently and quickly. I do remember, maybe my child brain kind of filled in the blanks on this one, and I could just be misremembering the cartoon, but I feel like there was scenes of the big giants, like, abducting children. I don't think it showed them, like, devouring them, but I think there was at least a scene of them kind of stalking the cities. Something like that would have grounded the narrative stakes a little better, I think. And yeah, it might have been a little like, ooh, scary if you're under 5 years old, but like, I think that, you know, to me, specifically with Spielberg, that's always something he's been able to do.
And been good at
is has been able to make a movie that fills you with wonder and, you know, an awe, a sense of joy of cinema, blah, 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 blah. But also can he turn on a dime and do Hitchcockian setups. And so I was kind of surprised how slick and glossy and kind of ephemeral and this entire thing was.
It was all the very, very happy, happy Spielberg. There was none of those dread.
Yeah, I mean, like, other than like some of the stuff, like when she first sees him through the bedroom window, and there's a few moments where you're like, oh yeah, this is Spielberg. But a lot of it, like, I felt like this could have been a Chris Columbus joint.
Well, going to that, I mean, so talking about like Amblin stuff and stuff like that, so a lot of my favorites weren't necessarily Steven Spielberg's. You know, my favorite were like Gremlins. That was written by Chris Columbus.
Yeah, and directed by Joe Dante.
which makes a whole hell of a lot of difference.
Yeah.
Or The Goonies. You know, those were a few of my favorites of or The Poltergeist. That was the other one. Also directed by Tobe Hooper. And people say that it's mostly Spielberg. I disagree. No, I don't know. This film, it feels meandery. It doesn't necessarily... It does have some light, some moments are kind of fun or whatever, but it didn't leave necessarily a bad taste in my mouth, but it just didn't necessarily leave any taste in my mouth.
Yeah. Which, you know, for me personally is almost worse. Mm-hmm. Because it just doesn't really accomplish anything. Like it just sits me there for 2 hours. I mean, I'll say this, the girl, Ruby Barnhill, who plays Sophie, she's good. You know, Steven Spielberg knows how to direct children.
I think in stops and starts, there were times where I was like,
there's some, because basically she's working with an entirely CGI environment.
Sure.
For the most part. And then a few kind of sets and stuff. And so I thought a lot about this movie in comparison to the Jungle Book movie, which we saw not that long ago. And, you know, comparing and contrasting the child performances. I think they both do a pretty good job, given what they have to do. Mark Rylance as the BFG and all the voice talent of the other giants and that stuff. I think Jermaine Clement does a voice in there, Bill Hader. That's all fine. I like the language of it. Roald Dahl's writing is still in there with the actual, you know, verbiage of the giants and that kind of stuff. It's fun to listen to, and it's a vivid kind of creation of a world that he's built. But yeah, I don't know. The movie being so safe and so slick.
Sanitized
in a way. I think, you know, because the thing about Roald Dahl's material that is interesting is he wrote for children, but he was also kind of a satirical writer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also pretty edgy for what he was doing. And a lot of these, the common thread between his children's stories is that it's all about children who live in very hostile worlds,
mm-hmm.
where everything is sort of out to get them. And adults especially are not to be trusted. And you see that kind of that influence on like J.K. Rowling's work and that kind of stuff. But you don't get any of that here. I think the satire, if there was any in the BFG, is not really here. And there's,
I think it is lightly, but it's not punctuated, so you don't really feel like anything about it. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
Like, I also remember, like, I thought that there were, when they were first talking to, like, the adults, like, I thought when the kid was specifically like, hey, you know, there's this thing happening, they didn't believe her. But mm-hmm. then once the BFG, like, stood up and did his part, then they started to believe. Like, but I it's been so long, that's like, I don't know what I'm making up in my head about that story.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's some discrepancy between our possibly sepia-toned memories of this property and what it actually was or is. And I think, you know, it is very faithful. I remembered every scene as it appeared. I just remembered it meaning something a little bit more. And I think part of that also has to do with the fact that fucking motion capture just isn't scary. It's not, or even all that. You can make something look as real as possible, and then you get into that whole Uncanny Valley territory. And this movie kind of hangs out around Uncanny Valley. It's not directly in the middle of it, but it brushes up against it for sure. And there's something about it that even when all this crazy stuff is happening in these worlds that they've built, and they try and put some sort of like actual sets and set pieces around the girl to include scale, but a lot of it just feels like ones and zeros, especially when he's like picking her up and doing stuff. You can tell she's on a crane and they've animated a hand around her. I don't know. Like, I never really felt like there was a tangible world. Like, unlike the crude animation of the 1989 cartoon, there's something always tangible about that.
Well, but, I mean, it depends, because I think it was good to kind of think about the Jungle Book in comparison.
Yeah.
Because I did feel the peril there. And I did, you know, even though that was very much in the same kind of ballpark, you thought that there was things that could get this kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that might be a way that they did it. And also scale is always hard to work with, because you're dealing with such large things.
Mm-hmm.
That might make it a little harder too. It's weird where they decide to kind of, it also might be in the design work a little bit, because they try to kind of do that original design look of the, like, that is in the books.
Mm-hmm.
But then they try to make it uber realistic at the same time. And so it's somewhere in this part where you're looking at it and you're like, that's not exactly working. Because if I'm being honest, if I look at something like Planet of the Apes, which is largely also our Rise of the Planet of the Apes, or the sequel, that's also largely motion capture.
Mm-hmm.
I still feel like I'm in that world, and I'm not as distracted by it. I'm not a proponent against that. I think that you can do these fantasy, but when you have strange aesthetics, because I that's the other thing that I guess kind of bugged me about this film, was I didn't feel like there was a strong aesthetic appeal to it. It felt slick. That's what it felt like. But it felt like very standard stamp kind of CG. It didn't feel like he was like, oh, I really want to go with this look for it and mm-hmm. this feel for the film. But again, I don't know. If I go back to it, and if I had watched this with a kid, I might have been a little... I wouldn't be as necessarily as harsh on it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's necessarily bad. It's a good way to spend a couple hours with bonding, which there was a ton of kids in the audience with their grandparents.
Well, I mean, I was in a mostly empty theater. I think there was like two kids who were behind me and they were kind of talking through the movie. But no, I mean, it's like I said, it's fine. It's not offensive in any way. It's just not really anything.
Well, you want to, I think it's also because it's Steven Spielberg, so you want to put your
finger. Expectations are higher, yeah. If this had been, you know, John Turteltaub's The BFG, I probably just wouldn't have went. But going to a Steven Spielberg movie and knowing what he can do, I was surprised how little of it he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this isn't quite as bad as like Jack and the Giant Slayer, but it's in that ballpark.
Yeah, because I wasn't as negative on that as either. And there were definitely things that are worse about that film than this one, but it's sort of in similar vein. Yeah. Besides just the giant stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The one thing I would say about that, if we're doing the comparison game, though, too, is I would say that that one at least seemed like it had, while the CG wasn't pulled off as well or the scale wasn't pulled off as well, I would say that had more of a look to it than this film. That's what surprised me about this one, is I was like, the only thing that was kind of like had a look to it was when they were at the tree, the dream tree.
Right.
But then other than that, I was just kind of like, eh, okay.
Yeah, that's one of the few sort of transcendent moments of the movie, that where you feel like it's sort of a tangent. It's, I mean, you have to talk about that stuff because it comes into the plot later.
Mm-hmm.
But they spend a decent amount of time on that set piece, mm-hmm. and it actually feels like maybe Spielberg was sort of inspired something about that. I can't say exactly what, but you know, maybe something has to do with like movies being the, you know, dream factory or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. It's fine.
It's, yeah. Again, it just while we're talking about it, I do wonder about that hook thing, and if maybe the adults were right about that.
Well, no, I you know, there's a handful of movies that our generation loves because we were the exact right age. You know, mm-hmm. Goonies being one of them. That's a movie. Like I remember that one. What was that one?
I still think that's amazing. You're wrong.
While We're Young, the Noah Baumbach film, when. Ad Rock is talking to Ben Stiller and he's like about the Adam Driver character. He's like, yeah, in the same night he can watch Psycho and Hook. And then Ad Rock's like, wait, who decided Hook was a good movie? Or not Hook, Goonies.
Oh, okay.
Who decided Goonies is a good movie? So yeah, Goonies being one of them, you know, the original Ninja Turtles being a movie that was basically ridiculed by adults but loved by children. So there is this nostalgia thing for a certain era of film that we love. But I think that's something that those movies had over this, even Hook, which I can see now as an adult would be obnoxious if you're not at the right age, you know, all the bangarang stuff and, you know, the kind of phoniness of the sets and a completely unbridled performance from Robin Williams. Yeah. You know, at the very least you have one very good central performance from Dustin Hoffman in that movie that I think even people at the time could agree was captivating. And I think that there's a bigger sense of stakes in that story. You know, a kid dies in the movie and there's the set pieces are a little bit more grounded in story than this movie is. This movie just kind of lilted along.
Yeah. Like I said, it's very meandery. For a book, I think the pacing is appropriate, but like not because you can kind of take those moments and extend them and time runs different.
In right.
A film, time runs a very specific meter. You have to continually move forward.
It's not necessarily a plot driven story. I mean, it has a story, you know, it has a.
Well, I just mean the main narrative, the thing that's happening in front of you.
No, I know that what I'm saying is that main narrative is not really hinging on big plot points. It's a little bit more about, you know, escapism, and that's fine. But what you can do in a book that this movie didn't bother doing is you can ground what is a basic kind of narrative structure in an emotional reality. This movie doesn't really do that. And that's a problem. That's why I think why I wanted it to either be scarier or to be a little bit more wonderful in if they wanted to take in that direction. Like it doesn't really have much of an emotional weight to anything. It all just kind of floats along.
Well, I think we've pretty much drilled that one home.
Yeah. Let's go ahead.
Both of us.
Let's go ahead and get into the do-over.
Sure. So the do-over is, like we were talking about early, it's this Netflix original. Specifically, it's one of the Adam Sandler ones. The setup is basically David Spade has this lackluster life that he's not really that into, and he is at his reunion, and his his wife is dancing with this man, and but then all of a sudden, you know, he comes in contact with one of his old, you know, an old buddy of his that he hasn't seen in years, and they kind of like strike it off and kind of get kind of nostalgic and kind of start talking. And then all of a sudden he gets swept up in this whirlwind of identity changes and faking their deaths, and all sorts of hijinks ensue.
Essentially, Adam Sandler's character decides for him that if you're not so satisfied with your life, then I got a plan. We're going to take the identities of these two bodies I found at a morgue that I work at, and we're going to assume their identities. And of course, they're rich and they live in like Puerto Rico and this man.
Oh, their identities. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the identities that they assume are of these rich people who live in Puerto Rico in a mansion. And immediately, you know, like, oh, so clearly these two people were not on the up and up, and they're going to be stalked by gangsters any minute now.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what happens.
This film is like 40. Like for the Sandler fan, this is like a 45, 50 year old man wish fulfillment fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
What's kind of weird is when I first was watching it, I was kind of almost okay with it. It wasn't as broad of humor, and it was kind of subdued, and you were just getting this kind of like this kind of fairly grounded story about, you know, a man that's not very much into his life, and Sandler himself wasn't as bombastic as he's been in a lot of his films. As it goes on, it starts getting broader and broader, and the tone really changes.
Mm-hmm.
You get introduced to certain characters, like since they assume these other identities, you get introduced to this character named Paula Patton. Her name's Heather, but the actress is Paula Patton. Mm-hmm. And she's like she is the wife of the person that David Spade's character took on the identity of. And she's kind of wooden, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of gets into this whodunit, unraveling who these people are movies.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's not. There's a point in time where this is just like an Adam Sandler movie. And there's points in time where it's kind of a standard, I don't know.
Crime comedy.
Yeah, that's. And so I wasn't as offended as when I've watched a lot of his films, except for moments. It gets pretty. I don't know. I struggled because when there were moments that were a little less talking about sanitation, when there was moments that were less friendly,
mm-hmm.
and it had some rough edges, I was a little like, oh, I haven't seen that for a while. But I wasn't necessarily charmed by that either.
Right.
And I don't know if it's just how it was done or what. But again, this is kind of similar to me as our BFG kind of review. This didn't really leave anything in my mouth. I wasn't necessarily offended by it. I watched it. It was there. It happened at me for a couple hours and spent the time away. I if you're an Adam Sandler fan, I could see this being okay. An okay experience for you.
I'm kind of with you in saying, like, when it started out and I saw what the setup was,
mm-hmm.
and I saw what Sandler was doing with his character, which seemed a little bit more interior than we've seen from him in a while.
Right.
I wasn't laughing, but I was something I could tolerate. I was like,
I wasn't laughing there either. I don't think that the first part of the film is designed to be a broad comedy.
No, I don't. I'm not sure what it is and what isn't.
It switches gears once you kind of get into their life. Into their new lives, I mean.
Right. No, I mean, I understand, you know, the structure of the movie and how it ratchets up the craziness as it goes.
Well, it doesn't, it's not about, for me, about how it functions. The gears, I understand that as well. What I'm saying is that it shifts tones, like, completely.
No, yeah.
It becomes a different thing.
The movie's a tonal disaster. And I think overall a disaster, narrative and tonal. The you know what's not funny?
What?
Cancer. You know what's also not funny? Exposition. And this movie's full of both of those things. I feel like this was a movie that was like written as one person's script, like one of those like kind of blacklisty scripts that's like a little off and a little weird and like, you know, gets picked up and then eventually they kind of try and shape it into something they can sell. Mm-hmm. And I felt like somewhere in that shaping, probably when they had Adam Sandler attached to it and Stephen Brill directing it, it turned into something else. And it turned into one of those doofy Adam Sandler movies where he, you know, and I say this as a person who wasn't always an Adam Sandler hater. I still think like his first like three or four movies are watchable.
Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore,
The Wedding Singer. Yeah. An argument could be made for like Big Daddy or something. I don't know. But
sure.
At a point, he gave the fuck up. And he knows that his audience, this is why I have a hard time with him, and why I think a lot of people don't want to give him the benefit of the doubt anymore, is because his stuff is so obviously cynical. He knows that his audience are not that discerning, and they don't really care, so he does as little as he has to. He, as a comedian, he doesn't even really try to find the joke in a setup or a situation anymore. He just kind of does these comedic set pieces or stupid characters.
You might disagree with me. It's kind of a black humor thing, but he, where he keeps showing people the phone,
yeah,
that, in appropriate ways. I thought those jokes were actually landed and were pretty well done.
But I'll say this in defense of the movie. It's, there was a few places I laughed at some of the dark comedy stuff. That was one of them. I thought that was a funny callback. I liked the, there's a scene in the movie. This is probably the only time I like actually kind of guffawed. When they're, it's like a montage scene where they're having fun on a boat or whatever, and they reel in this gigantic fish, and then he like beats it to death with a mag light, and you see the blood spurting all over, David Spade, and he has this look of horror on his face. Just the how they place that in kind of a having fun montage, I thought was, somewhat inspired. I struggle to find any other places I laughed all that much. Even at the, situational comedy of them like taking on these other lives and being stalked. Basically everything in the movie plot wise, I could predict from a mile away. There was stuff in the movie that was quote unquote a reveal that I had figured out pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
So really didn't like happen for me on an emotional level, if that's what they were going for. I think this movie wanted, you know, maybe that earlier draft I'm talking about wanted to be something like a Shane Black comedy. And it ended up not really being that. And then on top of that, you have all of the sort of misogyny that you can expect from an Adam Sandler film. You know, the women are either not to be trusted, or they're crazy bitches, or they're just something, you know, to ogle at, or all of the above. All of the gay panic humor that runs throughout the movie. Old ladies are weird, and let's look at their wrinkly boobs. So that you have that kind of eighth grade bullyish thing that kind of runs through the already pretty dark humor of the movie that, augments and clashes at the same time. I don't know. As the movie went, I was kind of with it for the first 20 minutes. And I felt like, oh, Sandler's kind of sort of building a character here. Interesting. And this movie actually looks like a movie. It doesn't look as cheap and like he just went to go have a vacation somewhere, although there is a bit of that, as like, you know, the Grown Ups movies or whatever. And there's at least an attempt at plot. And then the plot becomes so overwhelmingly complicated and twisty for no reason, to the point that it actually sort of devours the comedy. And then on top of it, the comedy's not really all that funny. I think it's a pretty bad movie, but if you're grading on a curve, it's like a C- for a Sandler movie.
I more or less agree with what you're saying. I guess my only thing is the more broad comedy aspects of the movie I wasn't into. Mm-hmm. The actual just like, I didn't think it was necessarily that complicated, the plot. You see that in a lot of like your mysteries or thrillers or whatever, and it was pretty whatever. If it had just been that, and not the broad comedy, and it would have still had the same actors and everything in it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually might have liked this film more. It wouldn't have blown me away, but I might have just been like, oh, that's not bad. You know, and it just had a few of those kind of chuckly moments or whatever. But when it shifts tones, that's pretty much when I go, I'm not really interested in this film anymore.
But, and it never stops shifting. Once it shifts into like the dark comedy zone, and then once it's, you know, the body count starts to stack up, and then it, it'll go from like this scene of them being chased on a road and like people or cars are flipping over into the next scene where David Spade is worried about getting laid with Paula Patton. And it's like, you've just been like chased down a road. You're running for your lives. Like this would not, why is this scene happening? And then it goes back into like, you know, oh, the cure for cancer and da, da, da. And then it's all over the place. It never really decides a tone throughout the movie, even if it's playing within a genre.
See, I thought it shifted to broad comedy because some of the stuff that you're talking about, I thought was pretty standard in other films I've seen, but it didn't really, I don't know. It, to me, as soon as it switched to, we're definitely going to be, no matter if it was dark, whatever, as soon as it switched to, yes, we're going to be a broad comedy, I was like, eh, shoulder shrug. Yeah, again, this film is, if we're talking C-minus and all that kind of...
If we're comparing this to, you know, if we were, like, putting this on the list of, like, crime comedies in general, it's like a D. But if we're looking at just Adam Sandler's recent work, mm-hmm. you know, it's at least a movie. It has a story. There's set pieces.
I think you're probably talking about, you were not very favorable on the grown-up movies.
No, they're fucking awful. They're not even movies. They're not. There's these actors went on a vacation and they had a camera there, I guess. That's the
situation to situation. Sure.
Right. They're totally insulting. And then, you know, the Jack and Jills, which are just outlandish beyond the point of reasonability. Yeah, it's more of a movie than that. And like I said, Adam Sandler I'm not saying he's really stretching his abilities or he's not doing a whole lot more than we've ever seen him do, but he is, there is something that approaches acting in this from both of him and David Spade. So there's stuff here that gives you glimmers of what either of these actors are capable of, or what either of these, what the Happy Madison brand could possibly be. But I think they let their worst habits get in the way of their work. The movie has a certain gross out quota it feels like it needs to appease. And I'm okay with like subversive dark comedy, and I'm okay with even like doing gross out comedy if it's appropriate for the story. It just never is. It feels like somebody went and redlined the script and said, okay, nothing's happened here for a while. Can we throw in a ball joke?
Yeah, I could agree with that. Those were the more vulgar stuff was the stuff that I was least interested in, mm-hmm. and was the most, it's the stuff that pushed me away for the most. I don't know. To me, it's kind of low hanging fruit. I agree that Adam Sandler is not bad in this. Even as it goes through and it shifts, I don't think he's actually the worst part in the film. Actually, I think he does okay throughout.
I had a kind of a funny thought. There's mm-hmm. the first scene where you see him, pull out a gun and mm-hmm. he's like taking out the bad guys.
Right.
And he's kind of sort of built in this movie. I think he worked out maybe a little for this, or like maybe worked out for something else. Or maybe he's just not playing a dad with a baggy shirt. I don't know. But I kind of thought like he could maybe do an action film now. Like mm-hmm. if he wanted to shift gears in his career and he wouldn't be like The Rock or something like that. But if he were to play like opposite The Rock in a real action movie, not one that him and his friends made in somebody's backyard, he could maybe do it.
Sure. This made me think of one of the early Sandler movies, Bulletproof.
Yeah, I thought a lot about that movie too.
It's in the ballpark. Bulletproof. I guess really what I'd tell people, if you really want to, if you need something new, I guess maybe try this out. But just watch Bulletproof if you want this kind of film. I don't know. His aesthetic, I just think that the general body of people has grown out of. But there are times that the humor in this gets to like it's interesting because you can push some of his like some of those ball jokes and stuff a lot further than you could, like, especially if you're going to release this in theaters. Like, he could never do that. And this is the only place you could do that was on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily make the jokes better. It just makes them grosser.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is a mixed bag. If you're into Sandler, I guess try it out. If not, I have nothing really of substance to say about this film, to be honest. And when these kind of films kind of come, I have a hard time kind of placing my thoughts on them because it's just mostly empty calories.
I don't know. I found it a little more actively offensive than empty calories, but because to me, the BFG is empty calories. That's just like, it was a movie. This, I felt like there's obvious script problems. There's obvious tonal problems. And, you know, some of the humor is actually reprehensible. I can't recommend it. I really can't. And, you know, the only reason that I, wanted to look at this movie is it'd been a while since I've seen a Sandler movie.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically the Happy Madison productions, because those are of a different ilk than even some of the other ones he stars in.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see, are they still up to their old tricks? Like, have they figured something out? You know, now that he has the freedom of Netflix, you know, the setup of it being kind of more of a crime comedy as opposed to, you know, just him and his friends hanging out for 2 hours. Like, I thought maybe possibly there could be something here. And I don't know. I kind of think it's a lost cause.
Oh, yeah, that definitely. It seems like it's shifted a little. So if he keeps shifting in one direction, that could be good for him in general. And if you're a fan of his, I'm more talking to a hypothetical person who likes his stuff. Mm-hmm. I personally didn't really. I was into this for the first like chunk of the film, and then I can't even tell you what happened near the end. Like, honestly, I don't remember. And I only saw this a couple days ago. That's how. And usually for that means that I just completely zoned out. So it's not a great film. No, you're completely right in that sense. I just don't. To me, that this, if you're going to talk to me about films, this isn't going to be a film I'm going to talk to you about ever. So that's the truth. But when we sit down and we actually have to talk about it, I'm like, yep, it happened at me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Well, what do you have for us next week?
Next week, we're going to watch a little horror film it's caught a lot of buzz called We Are Still Here. It's a haunted house movie of sorts. If it was like more of a popcorn film, I would maybe be less interested in it. But because it's a little bit more of like your indie horror, maybe they have an interesting take on that. So, and I'm kind of a sucker for haunted house movies if they're done well. So,
okay.
I thought we'd check this one out.
Sounds good. If anybody has anything to say about The Do-Over, if you happen to catch it, the BFG, or We Are Still Here, or you just have a question you want to pose us or something, you can do so at our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us at Facebook at facebook.com/JabberPodcast. We're on Twitter at JabberPodcast. Tweet us any ideas or comments you have on the show. Or retweet us. We like that as well. You can find our regular Podbean archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can also subscribe to us and listen to us through iTunes, Stitcher, Zune, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as player.fm. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, as well as the content I provided for the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Friend of the show, Brad Decker, he runs a lit zine blog thingy over at panelandframe.com. And I don't know what's going to happen. He just recently accepted a job to work over in North California, over in the Bay Area, to be a theater teacher at a high school down there. So we'll see what happens with his creative endeavors. Also check out the other podcasts that we're loosely associated with. Leland, friend of the show Leland, over at olympiasdampercast.com. Rod and Denise down here in Southern California at their music podcast The Listening Party, and Patrick Over in Detroit at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational, which I believe you're recording an episode with him today.
I am, correct.
So you're doing a lot of podcasting today.
I am. Maybe I'll take a podcast nap between.
A pod nap.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one. Bye. Bye.